Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. If you have ever worked in the service industry, like bartender, waitress, whatever, you know firsthand that the path to financial freedom is going to look different from those who have always or will always work in the 9-to-5. So what are the ways in which you can reach your financial goals while living on an income funded largely by tips? Barbara Sloan has a lot of experience working in the service industry. She has parlayed that into a book about that called Tipped. And she is here to share her insights. Then, how much financial education did you have at age 17? Probably not very much, but entrepreneur and author Douglas Price is trying to change that for this next generation. He has written a book called 17 to Millionaire that goes through various personal finance topics relevant to that age and stage. And saving money while also saving the environment. Hélène Lauberge is the head of sustainability at IKEA Canada, and she has some tips and tricks and ideas for shopping sustainably, including their spare parts program. How did I not know about this? I totally need an Allen key. And is your cute little furry friend included in your will? If the answer is no, you might want to reconsider. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue Wills is here to talk about the importance of planning for your pet's future. Plus, a look at financial crime, what one Canadian company is doing to try and stop it. Jennifer Arnold is the CEO and co-founder of Minerva AI. She'll be here to talk about how artificial intelligence is being used to stop money laundering. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. I still have my Billy bookcases. Like millions of people around the world, I kitted out my early life with staples from IKEA. And now that I'm settled, I probably swing by less often and mainly for the Swedish meatballs, but I still have pieces in my house that bear the scars of many, many moves around the world. The initial cost was cheap, and it had to be back then, but the stereotypical knock on IKEA stuff is that it doesn't last, that it's fast furniture and soon headed to the landfill. But is that accurate today? And will that be accurate in the future? And how do you shop sustainably these days? Hélène Lauberge is the head of sustainability at IKEA Canada. She joins us now from Edmonton to talk about sustainability. Hello there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You have been with IKEA for, I looked at your profile, like 17 years, first in Sweden, now in Canada. How has the company's approach to sustainability changed in that time?
Oh, it's a continuous development. And this is something that we take very seriously. We have a great design process that is called democratic design. So the sustainability aspect is actually built into the design process, and so is quality, for example. So we are making improvements year on year, and I could hear you mention Billy. So, you know, we have met Billy since a long, long time. Yes. And Billy is just getting better and better.
Now, some of our listeners will hear this commitment and think, really? Because they see, you know, the IKEA bookcases or chairs or whatever at the end of the driveway or headed to a dumpster somewhere, and they will have a harder time wrapping their minds around it when it's IKEA versus when it is, I don't know, Tiffany or some other company where the product is around for multiple generations. How much of that is perception and how much of it is reality?
I think it's a lot about perception. Just because it's expensive, it doesn't need to be, you know, good and lasting a long time. And that is what we are working hard on, to making long-lasting products available to an affordable price for the many. That's our mission. Mm.
There are two programs that I want to talk about because I had heard of neither of them. One is a sell-back program. How does that work?
You can sell back your used furniture to IKEA. And that is actually a great way to give somebody else the opportunity to buy a product, a piece of furniture, to an affordable price. And you get a store credit. So you can actually, depending on what you need, you can actually buy something new. So that is how that works. And it's quite successful. We have had around 3,000 pieces sold back to us so far.
And then you put them, what do you do with them? You sell them to another human who wants to buy them in your store?
Yes. So we do have a second hand that's called the Circular Hub or the As Is Sales Corner. So what quite many people do when they enter the store, they first go and visit the Circular Hub to see if there is anything that they can get to a really good price. It's not only furniture that has been sold back to us. It's also all displays, and it could be furniture that has been returned for any reason, but that are still in a decent condition so that somebody else can enjoy them.
What about a half jar of that delicious jam? Is that available?
Sorry.
No, okay.
No.
You also, the second one is a spare parts program. And I think this is the one where I think, oh yeah, I could totally use this because I have a dresser and the tracks on the dresser don't work properly. The wood's totally fine, but it's probably 20 years old. So would I be able to get a spare part for this dresser?
You would, and it's free. So either you come into the store and ask for that particular spare part, or you go online and order it, and it will be sent to you for no charge. And this is really how we want to encourage people to take care of the furniture and make them live longer. We are also working on developing repair kits and different ways for our customers to take care of the furniture and make them live longer. There is lots going on in this area because we really believe in helping customers to make their furniture live longer.
The things that we're talking about are fairly close to the end of the life cycle of the furniture in that it's, you know, in someone's home or has been in someone's home maybe for some time. If we go all the way back to the beginning, when it's an idea in a designer's mind, where does sustainability start and what does that look like? Are you, growing synthetic wood from crickets? I just made that up, by the way. Is that a thing? Could that be a thing? Could you make that a thing? Could you make a bookcase out of crickets?
Sounds like a great idea that we would probably
If anybody can do it, it's the Swedes. The Swedes will totally do it.
Yes. Yeah. When we design or develop a product, as I said, sustainability is one of the dimensions that we are looking at. And first of all, it's about looking at the materials that we are going to use. So is it, can we use a recycled material or is it a renewable material? And going forward, we won't be able to develop any product unless it's made out of a renewable material or a recycled material. And then it's about designing for standardization to make sure that we can have spare parts available when there is a need to change something out. And that could be not only because something is broken, but it could be also because you want to upgrade, you want to change the look, you want to, just make it more fun, a bit different. And then it's really also about looking at different ways of repairing and making the furniture last longer. So there are solutions for that we are looking into. So I think the sustainability aspect is really well taken care of in our design process. And of course, that includes quality too, because otherwise, it must go hand in hand. Otherwise, there is no point.
My Billy bookcases will not last forever. I am still young. They still are relatively young, even though they're decades old. But at a certain point, they will be done and they may not be good for anybody at that point. Where can IKEA furniture be recycled?
So it depends on where you are and that particular city's recycling capabilities. But that is also something that is now built into that design process. So we are also designing for recyclability. So it's going to be possible to easily separate the different materials so that you can take care of that product in a good way when it's time.
What has changed in your personal behavior given this accountability as head of sustainability at IKEA? So clearly you think about it all day, every day in the context of the retailer that you work for. What has changed for you as a human on this planet?
I think just having a better understanding of the importance of secondhand furniture. And when I look at my own home, I am glad to say that I have a mix of, inherited furniture, but also furniture that I bought secondhand. And for example, I wanted to upgrade my dining table. So then I actually, it was an IKEA dining table, surprise, but I sold it back. And then I actually got a new one, and a new one I found in the Circular Hub. So, having that thinking, I think that is so, so important. But it's also about knowing what you're buying. And I'm definitely way more conscious now with understanding where different products are coming from, where they are made and what they are made out of, and so forth. Mm. So, yeah.
Very interesting. Ellen, thank you for sharing your insight with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ellen Loberg is the head of sustainability at IKEA Canada. She was in Edmonton today.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
People love true crime. It is one of the top genres of the podcast world, and it is a long time staple on television too. The conversation that we're about to have is about as close as I will ever get to true crime. We are going to talk about financial crime and money laundering in particular, and what tech companies are doing to try and stop it. Minerva AI is a platform that provides, get this, financial crime risk management solutions. We're going to find out what that actually means. Jennifer Arnold is the CEO and co-founder of the company, and she's here to tell us about it. Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
What are some examples of crimes that you are trying to detect? This is not like basic shoplifting at the Circle K.
No, absolutely not. So when we are talking about money laundering, we are trying to understand if banks or other financial services providers are enabling criminals to launder money from the proceeds of crime. So human trafficking, wildlife poaching, drug dealing, terrorist financing. Those are just some of the things that fall under that financial crime umbrella.
And if there were no sort of policing of this, they would earn this money through poaching or human trafficking. It would arrive in cash, and then they would just go put it in their bank account. But there is policing, and so there are systems that would detect that money doesn't have a source grounded in traditional business. How do you see what's going on there?
Yeah, so we look at it from really two angles. One is examining transactions of an individual or an entity to see if those transaction patterns fit with what we expect them to do. So I'm Jen Arnold and I live in Canada and I have a checking and savings account. And then all of a sudden, my savings account is getting hit with $50 here and $50 there coming into my account really quickly. And then I bundle it all up and I send it somewhere else. So from a transactional perspective, that would set off an alert at a bank and someone would go investigate to find out what you're up to.
So your clients would be banks. The layer that you're adding in is fairly sophisticated artificial intelligence here. I'm sure you look at a gazillion variables. You gave us one there that was, simple transaction activity. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other variables that you look at that may be more, that may be surprising? Like, are you looking at the temperature in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia? Are you factoring in whether they have their teeth cleaned? What else goes into this equation?
Yeah, so for an individual, many components. We're going to look to see if you're on a sanctions list or if you're considered someone who is politically exposed, which is typically someone who holds a position in public office of some description. We'll look at adverse media. So we'll go through several years of media to understand if there was anything ever anywhere where you are identified as a criminal or a fraudster or something like that. We look at what's available in terms of criminal and legal proceedings. That's public information. And that's how we go about composing that risk profile. We really look at the individual who's doing the transacting. What risk comes with them? Who do they know? Who do they do business with? where does their money come? What do they do for a living?
I'm sure I have a very dated view about the strength of the technology that would power all of these things, but I'm picturing a mainframe computer the size of Rogers Center and about 1,000 people in white lab coats scurrying around, pushing buttons and things. What's the reality here? Is this basically all now happening on your phone while you're drinking a margarita in Boca?
Oh, Lord, that would be delightful, but no. So to some degree, and not for us, but for some solutions, there's definitely a bunker somewhere filled with human beings running around doing work. From our perspective, we are completely cloud-based, so we don't have that many humans working and doing that assessment. And the AI that we've built with Minerva is something very sophisticated and new in that she's able to understand context and sentiment when she's consuming information. So she can identify certain risk attributes associated with information surrounding an individual or an entity. And then she's really good at bringing all of those pieces together. So imagine I'm looking for Bruce Sellery and Google search would bring me back every Bruce Sellery on earth, but I'm looking for one Bruce Sellery. Minerva's going to find my one Bruce Sellery and then bring back all of the information that I need to understand around the risk that comes with him from data sources, you know, throughout the internet.
There are two Bruce Sellerys. I am distantly related to the other one. He lives in California. He's significantly older than me, just so you know. I also love that you have personalized her. She has a gender. She has a name. How did you go about building her? It sounds like, you know, a lot of years with unbelievably smart people.
Oh my, yes. So our chief technology officer is... I don't know, I'd say nothing short of a miracle. He was building investigation tools for cancer research when we met him. I explained to him the problem we were trying to solve around money laundering and especially around human trafficking. And he was really excited by that. So in 2018, we kind of went dark for 2 years and just built out the brain that is Minerva and spent that time teaching her how to think.
Wow. Now, there has been more and more focus on cryptocurrency over the last couple of years.
Boy.
And the belief that it enables criminals to move money around more easily and outside of traditional banks and banking systems. What is true and what is not true about that belief?
Well, I think you can tell if you look at, I don't know, regulatory fines going to traditional financial institutions, I think that you will find that there may be actually no more or less risk in crypto than there is in traditional finance. It's just that the codification and the how we do that work in traditional financing is well understood, and we don't have the pseudo-anonymization piece that you do have in crypto. But in terms of like propensity for evil, I would say they're probably relatively equal.
Really? Okay. Well, speaking about evil, where is the world headed? Who's winning? Is it the superheroes or is it the villains?
Well, I will tip my hat to the villains and acknowledge that there is no other population that is more creative and inventive. As we develop controls, they are developing, you know, counter controls. So it's a constantly evolving space. And one of the advantages of working with Minerva AI, for example, is that she can evolve along with the industry and along with the regulation. So you're not going to be caught offside. I think the fight is a really tough one, and I don't think we're winning. I don't think the good guys are winning.
She is Canadian. You are Canadian. How does the Canadian ecosystem, for lack of a jargon-free word, in the world of AI and in particular fighting financial crime, how do we stack up globally? Are we, you know, are we in the top 10? Are we leading the thinking here, or are we just playing catch up?
Oh my goodness. I think it depends on the day. So if you were looking at the news in a year ago, we talked a lot about whitewashing or snowwashing in Canada in terms of being a haven for money laundering. And that is more or less true. And we've been doing it through things like real estate and other means for quite some time. In terms of technology, Canada, Toronto-Waterloo corridor is really, really, really I'd say, fairly competitive with what we see in terms of technology and talent in the South.
What's in it for the average Canadian? So I get what's in it for the typical bank, right? They want fewer transactions that are, you know, compromising their business and the way that they do business. But what's the vested interest that everyday folks, everyday taxpayers have in ensuring that this this world is appropriately policed and punished?
I think it comes down to the nature of humanity and what it means to live in society. We do not fare better on our own or when we take care only of our own self-interest. So from a societal perspective, being able to detect and eliminate like really heinous crimes like human trafficking, that's a win-win for everybody. You're literally making the world a better place for you, your family, your children, and everyone you know and everyone you will never meet. There's that very broad piece. And then there is comfort in knowing that you are not contributing unwittingly to the facilitation of those kinds of crimes.
Fascinating stuff. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Arnold is the CEO and co-founder of Minerva AI. And Jennifer, if you could please say hello to her for me. And I don't know, tell her that I'm a good person and have that built into her very significant artificial intelligence. We appreciate your time.
Amazing. Thank you.
Coming up next on Moolala, entrepreneur and author Douglas Price talks about his new book, 17 to Millionaire. And later, a focus on waitresses and bartenders and everyone who earns at least part of their living on tips. I'll speak with Barbara Sloan from Tipped Finance about the unique financial challenges that those who work in the service industry face. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can go to one of two places, moolala.ca. So you can, you know, search for a topic or a guest name or whatever on the website. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever it is that you listen to podcasts, and download the full show, download segments, write a review, subscribe.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. All right, let's think back to age 17. In my case, that was 13 million years ago. And if we think back 13 million years, what kind of personal finance knowledge did you have back then? Probably not a lot. Maybe because your school didn't teach it, your parents didn't talk about it, or maybe because you thought it was the single most boring thing a teenager could think about or talk about. Douglas Price wants to change this. He has written a personal finance book called 17 to Millionaire. And he joins us now to talk about what it's all about. Hello there.
Bruce, hi. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're 17. You're at Central Secondary School in London, Ontario. Are you a personal finance nerd from the way back?
Definitely not. Definitely not. I should clarify, I'm no longer 17 and no longer going to high school anymore.
That is abundantly clear. That is, you've been bathed in cryogenic fluid so you can remember what life was like back then, but you're not.
Right.
But you have a particular affinity for this demographic. And why is that?
You know what, Bruce? It's because when I started to develop an interest in personal finance about 5 or 6 years ago, it was because of actually my frustration with the fact that I didn't get any financial literacy training when I was in high school. So I kind of thought, why doesn't this exist? And so I thought, well, someone has to change this. And I told my friend at the time, I said, somebody in the school system has to change this. And at the time I was a teacher, and my friend said, well, you're in the school system. And I thought, yeah.
Wait a second. That's an idea. There is no paragraph longer than two sentences in this book. How did you put yourself into the TikTok, Instagram ready mindset of a 17-year-old?
Bruce, the way the book is written, it's designed to be fun, it's designed to be engaging, and it's designed to be read very, very quickly. So I just kept thinking, what is the book that I would want to read if I was 17 today? Like, what's a book that's not going to be like all these other dry, mind-numbing, like financial, thick volume books out there that are very, very difficult to read? What's going to be really fun and engaging and entertaining ultimately? And what is going to be a fantastic experience for a 17-year-old or anybody really, but specifically grade 12 students? And so that's what I tried to do. So yeah, as a result of keeping the paragraphs really short, the idea is hopefully we keep the attention and we just keep it all rolling right along.
This book is written for 17-year-olds, but it will likely be purchased by parents or teachers of 17-year-olds. What should they know about what you're trying to do here?
So specifically parents, if there are parents who have teenagers who, like, I mean, specifically 17-year-olds, this is a book that is designed to help fill the gap both in financial literacy training in high schools, as well as bridge the conversation that may or may not happen between parents and teenagers. I think every parent would agree that they feel on some level pressured to have the conversation about money with their kids, but those conversations can be awkward and tricky. And this book sets out to try to fill that gap. And actually, parents, they can give their teenager this book, and that is the first step in setting their teenager up for financial success. And in addition to that, the book, instead of the parent taking responsibility for having that conversation, there's actually three chapters that are carefully placed in the book that outline how the teenager can actually open up the conversation with the parent. And so as a result, what we do is we give agency to the kid, and suddenly they have control over their own learning, which I think is really, really important. And that's what we try to capture in this book.
I read that. I thought it was a smart move and a brave move to send the 17-year-old after their parents. Why did you incorporate that, especially given that some parents will be deeply uncomfortable by that conversation?
I think the reason why I decided to go about it that way is because for years and years and years, parents seem to be hesitant about having that conversation with their teenagers. So I thought, I wonder if there's just a different way to do this. And I think I started asking the question, why do parents hesitate about that? And the answer I kept coming up with was, maybe it's because parents don't have that much financial awareness themselves, and not their fault. Like, a lot of us were never taught in high school. Maybe you're the same. Bruce, were you taught anything in high
school? I took a course called The Mathematics of Investments in grade 12. So I cannot say I was not taught.
That is amazing. That's fantastic. And hopefully that will start to filter in more and more to different schools. But certainly for me, I wasn't taught anything. And I think a lot of parents are the same. And so if they are the same, then having that conversation with their teenager can sometimes open up a weakness that they have, or a lot of people find their ignorance around finance a sensitive topic. So as a result, it leads to difficult conversations. And sometimes these conversations just get put off, and then sometimes they just don't happen. So that's why we tried to reverse it.
There is lots of content and some tried and true concepts like the golden rules, 10% rule, as in save that first 10, pay yourself first, max out your TFSA. And I think the most magical thing that any person, young or old, needs to learn is the magic of compound interest.
Love it.
I wanna though focus on the 10% rule. That is a hard ask of someone who's in their first job to say, no, 10% goes to your future self. It does not go to, they're 17. So what are they spending on at 17? I was going to say beer. And then I thought, no one underage would ever spend money on beer. So it's not that. So tell us why you were so passionate about the 10% rule.
You bet. So Bruce, really the whole point and focus of the book is to try to build both an understanding as well as try to build a basics of habit building. So with the 10% rule, it's all about, look, it doesn't have to be a perfect system. You don't have to get it right each and every time, but it's about bringing an awareness to the reader. Hey, like, there's a different way to think about this. And a lot of people, I even mention it in the book, the order that a lot of us have in our minds is we make money, we spend money, and then we have nothing left over to invest. And what I encourage the reader to do is just develop that habit of rearranging the order in their mind. So we make money, we pay ourselves first, that 10%, I default to the 10%, and then we have the rest to spend. And it's that small mental adjustment that I say in the book is the first step to building wealth. And I think you'd agree with that.
I would agree with that, as a matter of fact. Now, one of the other things that I really liked about the book is you go through the paycheck, including how they will get taxed at source, which when I found out a bazillion years ago that I had to pay taxes, I was infuriated. But it's the reality of life as Canadians. What do you want readers to take away from that part in particular?
You bet. So that's in chunk number three. So for your listeners, basically the book is divided into five different sections. And the third section is what I call the road trip. And the reason it's called the road trip is because I tried to take the reader on a journey that leads us to the registered retirement savings plan. And I, through my teaching, I found that explaining the RRSP was very difficult because of all the other pieces of information that you need in order to connect the dots when it comes to understanding the ins and outs of the RRSP. So my challenge with writing the book was to figure out the right order of information to go in and to teach it in so that when we got to the RRSP, it all started to make sense. So with section number three, we go on this road trip and it starts with the obvious first step is, hey, we get our first job. Okay, if we get our first job, we're going to make a paycheck. We're going to see that paycheck. We're going to get a pay stub. We want the reader to open the envelope, take a look at the pay stub, and then we want them to be able to understand the information on it. I don't know about you, but I had to learn the hard way. I didn't have anybody telling me what CPP and EI was on my pay stub. I had to just figure it all out on my own. And I don't think there's any reason why kids should have to learn the hard way. So I thought, let's start there. Hey, also, when you look at your paycheck, that's not as much as you thought it was going to be. So why is that? Let's look at the ins and outs of that. And then that leads us to the progressive tax system, which leads us to total income versus taxable income and tax deductions. And ideally, when you add all those things together, once we get to the RRSP, it all starts to make sense.
Hopefully it all starts to make sense, and it is made easier with this book called 17 to Millionaire, its author, Douglas Price. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Bruce, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
A ton of great stuff in there. If you're an educator, get the book. If you're a parent of a 17-year-old or even a 25-year-old who hasn't got the basics down, go buy the book.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, I'll speak to Barbara Sloan from Tipped Finance to talk about her tips, pun intended, for building wealth when you work in the service industry. She has been a bartender, a waitress, a stripper. She's got lots of experience in this realm. But first, why you should consider including your who's a good dog pet in your will. Daniel Goldgut from Epilogue Wills is going to talk about the importance of planning for your furry friend's future. Don't forget that we have a newsletter. It includes all the stuff that we do here on SiriusXM, on CBC Radio, on CityLine. Go to moolala.ca. You can sign up for it there. It comes once a month. We don't do anything ever with your email address.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
If you have a beloved furry little friend in your life, you know that many pet owners consider that pet to be a member of the family. You might even believe it's important to plan for your pet's future in case you leave this earth prematurely. But you may not actually be following through and making those arrangements in the way that you should be. Joining us now to talk about why you might want to think about your pet when it comes to your estate planning and how you go about doing that is Daniel Goldgut. He is co-founder and CEO of Epilogue, an online will preparation tool. Hello, Daniel. How you doing?
Hi, Bruce. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
If you do nothing, you do not say anything about your cat, dog, ferret, lizard, and you die, what happens?
It's a good question. And it depends a little bit. So pets in the eyes of the law are considered to be property. So just like any other property that you have, that property is going to be disposed of.
So that was you realize that's a trigger warning for pet owners. I can't believe you uttered that phrase on the air, as accurate as it is. You have called Sparkle and Betty and Betsy property. Scandalous. Well,
I did say in the eyes of the law.
And yes, eyes of the law.
That's, I guess, where the big distinction gets made. People, as you said, off the top, view their pets much more like they view their children than they do their couch. And so, whereas in a will, when it comes to children, you're naming a guardian for your children. With pets, the term used is often guardian, but that's not really what you're doing. You're actually giving a gift of your pet to a specific person. Now, we know that that person is going to take on a guardianship role. But when you include a pet in your will, what you're doing is giving that pet as a gift to a specific person.
If you don't make that arrangement, if you don't specify, what happens? Like if you're a single person, you don't have a will, your stuff gets passed, I assume, passed to next of kin.
That's
your,
right.
Your dog goes too?
That's right. So in whatever province you are in, there are rules about what happens if you pass away without a will. And generally speaking, it follows a list as far as next of kin. So as you said, if you are a single person with no spouse and no kids, in most provinces, it's going to go up to your parents if your parents are alive, and no parents, it's going to go to siblings, nieces and nephews. And so because your pet is considered property, it's just going to be part of that, part of your assets that's going to go to whoever the province decides it should go to.
Right. Okay. So that's the, I didn't think about it, I didn't write it down method. What is the method of, no, I'm actually going to think about this. How does one choose whom should receive the gift of the pet?
So another really good question. And that obviously there's a lot of considerations out there. Are there other pet owners in your life? Are there other people in your life that know your pet, that understand how you care for your pet? And are there people who could sort of do the best job at giving your pet the life that they're, I'll call it, accustomed to? Mm. And so to love them and care for them in the way that you do. And so, you know, is there someone who lives close so that it's familiar for your pet, as opposed to, you know, to the cousin in Nova Scotia who might be your next of kin? And what would that look like for your pet?
Why do you think that so few families make arrangements for their pets?
I mean, I think there's probably two main reasons. I mean, the first is that so few people make arrangements at all.
At all.
And so that carries through, right? Like there's, you know, more than 50% of Canadian adults don't have a will at all, which means that not only have they not thought about their pets, but they haven't named guardians for children. They haven't named an executor. So, I mean, that's that first chunk of people who haven't done anything at all. And the second category, which might be a little bit tied to the first, is people just assume that everything is going to work out. You know, everyone will be reasonable and the person that should step up will step up. But that's just not how it works, right? Because the distribution is somewhat governed by the rules of the province, there's not so much, call it wiggle room. And so it is challenging to not plan for it in terms of what happens later. What if there's multiple people that think they're the right person? There's just sort of a host of issues that get created when you've done no planning at all.
Now, prior to Epilogue, you did work as a traditional estate lawyer, like in an office and doing these big, complicated estate plans. Did you see in that practice where pets became an issue?
Somewhat. So, I mean, I should say, when people think about pets in wills, oftentimes they think about sort of the cases that make the news. You know, the stories in the U.S. about someone creating a trust for their pet and leaving $50 million in it and stuff like that. That's the stuff that's sort of noteworthy. That's not what happens generally. I mean, in Canada and Ontario specifically, you can't do something like that. But you see the cases where, you know, someone just doesn't make any arrangements and no one steps forward. And then that's a real challenge. And or maybe no one outside the family, but they're not really now involved in this process, because if there was no planning that was done whatsoever, there's sort of a limited pool of people who are, call it, even eligible. And it can create a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. So the pet would end up, in that case, the pet would end up at the Humane Society.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. It would, you know, the person who would get the pet, because they were the one, according to the province, who should be in charge. If that person decided that they didn't want that pet, and the responsibilities that came with it, they would make their own decision about what would happen.
We have talked on this show about Epilogue and how, you know, the technology allows you to prompt users for think about this, think about this, think about this. Are pets a prompt on Epilogue, or do you have to know to tell that will creation software that you have a pet and you want to make a proper plan?
Yeah. So they are a prompt. So we ask the question, do you have any pets? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you are going to see another question that says, do you want to name a guardian for your pet? And like I said before, that's not, call it, the legal term, but that is the term that people recognize, and that's right. Understandable. So we say, do you want to name a guardian for your pet? And if someone chooses to do so, then we ask, do you want to name an alternate guardian? So if the person that you originally named is unable or unwilling to do it, is there someone else that you want to be there as a backup? And then we ask one more question, which is, do you want to make a gift, a monetary gift, to that person, either as a token of your appreciation or to actually assist with the care,
cover the food and the vet bills.
Yeah, and it's different if it's a dog or a cat or a horse, as far as what upkeep looks like and what costs look like. And so, you know, that's also entirely optional, but we give people that ability.
Now, pets don't live as long as humans. If you've got, you know, a dog or a cat, it could be 10 years, it could be 15 years, but it's not 30 years. How do you ensure that you keep that, you know, that will up to date? Do you name the pet, or do you just say, in the event that I die and I've got pets, here is how that would be resolved?
Yeah, so I think there's probably some different practices out there. At Epilogue, our practice is to not name the pet specifically, and to say, you know, the language, and it's a bit legalese in terms of what the will actually says, but it's sort of, you know, in the vein of any domestic animals living with me at the time of my death, they would go. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, people in their, you know, 30s and 40s and 50s who are making wills, who have a pet, whose life expectancy is certainly shorter than their own, sometimes don't think about it or don't think it's necessary. But it is, right? Like in the sense that you want to plan for everything, and your wishes should reflect your situation right now. And if in 3 or 5 or 10 years those change, you should update your will accordingly.
Really interesting stuff. Daniel, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Daniel Goldgut is the co-founder and CEO of Epilogue, which is an online will preparation tool. We were talking about how to ensure that your pet is cared for in the event of your death. Coming up, our next guest argues that working in the service industry comes with financial work hazards. One of them is alcohol. She isn't judgmental about it, but her take is really, really interesting. Barbara Sloan spent her career in clubs and bars, and she has written a book about navigating your financial life when you're working for tips. Here's a tip. I'm the money columnist for CBC Radio. Tune in Wednesday afternoons. We dig into some money-related topic relevant to you, relevant to your financial life. It's in there too.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The path towards financial freedom looks different for everyone. I mean, we know this, right? But when you work 9 to 5, it looks very, very different than if you work a tip-based job in the service industry. My next guest built a career in that industry. She knows exactly what it is like to live off a tipped income. Her name is Barbara Sloan. She's the author of Tipped, the life-changing guide to financial freedom for waitresses, bartenders, strippers, and all other service industry professionals. She joins me now from New York City. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
You are right. Personal finance advice is massively skewed to people who have salaried jobs. What are some of the examples of what's different for people who derive at least a portion of their income from tips?
The income side is completely different for people who are on a tip-based income. So they're operating off of a fluctuating income. For the majority of people on 9 to 5, they're not familiar with what that means. But for people who maybe are entering the gig economy, consultants, have their own businesses, They're more familiar with that, and they know that that means that budgeting is harder, that tracking your income becomes a lot more important. And so for people who are working on tips, those are the things that we start to talk about with them, is that they need to be more educated about tracking their income, tracking their tips, and learning how to budget while on a fluctuating income.
This book was not a theoretical exercise for you. I mean, you write very authentically and openly about your journey and your job history as a pole dancer, as a waitress, as a coyote ugly bartender, like all the things. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so powerful. You have incredible credibility having walked this path yourself. What was the insight? What opened your eyes to the, I don't know, opportunity to learn more about personal finance?
This inflection point came in 2013, 2014. I had just moved to New York, and I had gotten a job in New York working at Coyote Ugly, and I had gotten another job working on Wall Street doing accounting. And I was working for it was part trading floor, part independent sales organization that was doing something like loan sharking. And I got to see the ugly side of financial services, the predatory side of financial services. I left that job after 6 months, and I got a new job working at a construction company, one of the companies that I now own. And I was tasked with setting up a benefits system, HR. It was in getting to see all of those benefits, the 401k, the health insurance, the paid time off, the pre-tax benefits, all of these benefits, where I realized that people who live on tips are constantly getting pushed back behind the starting line. For people in the 9 to 5 world, anytime they need to take a day off, they typically get paid for that day off. Majority of Americans have on average 20 days of paid time off. For people in the tipped world, that's not a reality. So anytime you take a day off, you are losing money. Anytime you have a health event, you are pulling money out from your savings if you have it, or you're going into debt for it. Whereas most Americans have these benefits, which really are financial safety nets.
It sounds like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you crawled through the wardrobe into this world that you couldn't even have imagined. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yeah. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is the reason that me and my peers have been left out of wealth building.
Right.
This is the reason we're behind.
There's flying unicorns here. Oh my gosh. Now, as I mentioned, you write very, very honestly about your experience. And one of the things that I found really compelling was about the costs of working in the service industry, in particular alcohol as a workplace hazard. Tell us why you characterize it in this way and how you learn to navigate it.
Yeah, I don't glamorize the industry, but it's important to note that every job has workplace hazards. The other career that I know as well as the service industry is construction. There's tons of workplace hazards. You just get training for how to navigate those hazards. In the industry, we are often not told and talked about how to manage alcohol as a present and constant force, not only in your work, but in your life. So I don't typically have an opinion on alcohol. A lot of us make our money from the presence of alcohol, but it is a hazard, and it's one that we need to be honest about how it's impacting us if we're drinking on the job, if we're drinking more after as a cost of winding down to the job, and maybe how it's impacting our guests, which can also be hazards in the industry.
Well, in construction, it's steel-toed boots and a hard hat is kind of the starter there. You don't go on a job site without those two things. What boundaries do you recommend people at least consider creating for themselves if they work in an environment where alcohol is served or is kind of a part of how transactions get done?
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head with the word boundaries. Boundaries are your steel-toed boots. So boundaries can look like a lot of different things. You can put in engineering controls where you are making it look like you're drinking on the job and you're drinking a seltzer. Maybe you're in a club and you're a dancer and you're going up to the club and you order your cocktail with a wink and the bartender knows that means to make you a fake cocktail. Or maybe it's just that you present the information to your guests and clients, like, actually, I'm not drinking on Thursdays, or I'm not drinking at all. Or, you know, sometimes it takes the form of abstinence completely. Sometimes it takes the form of making it look like you're drinking. It really depends on you.
You are really into the math, which I love. And one of the areas in particular that you talk about is how many hours do you have to work to pay for that? Why is that so critical for people to understand, do you think?
I think it's important for people to understand, especially in our industry, is because a lot of people after their shift go out. Our shifts are energizing, which is very different than what most people do for work. Most people leave their work drained and they want to go right home and they want to relax. When you leave a shift, you are energized and you need to burn off that steam. And that often looks like you going out afterwards. And that means you're spending a portion of the money. So whatever you're spending to wind down, that's a cost to you working. So you need to be informed in order to make educated decisions about where your money is going and if those are really aligned with your values. If you're only giving yourself a false choice of would I rather go out or not go out, then the choice is always going to be to go out. But if you say to yourself instead, would I rather not go out every single day and instead only go out once every other week and also max out my IRA and also go to Mexico at the end of the year? Then we have a totally different question that's based in your values and what's important to you.
One of the yeah buts that people in sessions that I do bring is I have unpredictable income. I work in the service industry. I work in the gig economy. I can't budget. Your book says, yeah, you can. What does it look like? Yeah, you can. What does it look like for a service industry professional?
Yeah. So people who you don't have to budget on your income. You can always budget on your expenses. So if your income is, you know, varying widely based on maybe you're in a job that's more seasonal, then maybe you want to budget based on your expenses and that you can keep your expenses more fixed. So you would start there. I always also encourage people to build in buffers. Let's say that you have a summer electric bill that's a little higher than your winter electric bill. Bump up what you would allocate to your winter electric bill so that you're ready and prepped for the time that your summer electric bill comes around. A lot of budgeting is just thinking ahead and getting an estimate of what you think your expenses are going to be. It's never going to be perfect. Nobody's budget's perfect. You and your life are perfect to start right now budgeting.
You write, you're a hustler. Hustle responsibly. What does that mean?
Hustle gets a bad rap right now. Like, it's almost a negative word in our culture and in the zeitgeist. And I think because for a lot of people in the 9-to-5 world, hustle translates to maybe working for free or, you know, sacrificing your wellness for the sake of a job. hustling in the service industry is largely self-defined in a lot of ways. We're entrepreneurs. And so we can hustle, but we also have to remember that we have to do it responsibly, meaning that like our industry has a little bit of golden handcuffs where you get addicted to that cash constantly coming in. And you have to remember that rest and relaxation and taking care of your body is important to you being able to stay in this industry long term. And so you have to be responsible with taking time off and going to get those. No boss in the service industry is like, yep, you've got to take your PTO or it's going to run out. Right. So you have to self-define, how many days am I going to take off? I do coaching as well. And I always tell my clients, like, you have to set up a PTO policy for yourself. And that includes taking days off for your mental health, for your annual physical, for a dental checkup. Nobody's going to tell you how to live your life. You have to do these things yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. The pro and the con of having so much agency. Barbara, I really appreciate your time today.
Bruce, this is great conversation. Thank you so much.
Barbara Sloan is the author of Tipped, the life-changing guide to financial freedom for waitresses, bartenders, strippers, and all other service industry professionals. And I got to tell you, how many personal finance books do I read? Like about 14 gazillion. And this one is genuinely different. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To get in touch with us with your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, your whatever, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms out there. On social media, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.